morning. It is 10:31 a.m. and you're listening to KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. I'm Chris Andre, and my guest for the next half hour is going to be Noura Erekat of the National Grassroots. She's a national grassroots organizer and legal advocate for the U.S. campaign to end Israeli occupation. There is a website. We'll have all of this information at the front desk, and we'll be repeating it later. But right now, if you want to take a look at what this organization is doing, you can go to www.endtheoccupation.org. It's a coalition of about 200 Palestinian solidarity peace and justice organizations in the country. And they're going to be, this group that Noura represents is active in a number of different fronts on behalf of the Palestinian people. That's a lonely place to be, because not very many people in the world today are on the side of the Palestinian people, and we'd like to address that and a couple of other topics. One thing I just like to mention to KBOO listeners is I just learned that Noura is married to one of my favorite musicians and Palestinian activist whom I admired greatly and interviewed last year, and that would be the Iron Sheik. So you may have heard his CDs. His music is terrific. He's got a couple CDs out now, possibly more. And for a while we had those at KBOO. So I was thrilled to find this out. And now I'd like to introduce you to Noura. She's going to talk a little bit about some civil suits being filed against two retired Israeli army officers. Now, those suits are filed in this country, is that right?
That's right, they're filed in U.S. federal courts.
And talk a little bit about those suits, would you please?
So let me start with talking about the law that underpins these suits. There's the Alien Torts Claims Act, which provides subject matter jurisdiction to bring these suits in federal courts, in U.S. federal courts, as well as a private cause of action to be able to bring these suits. Unlike other countries that have universal jurisdiction, such as the UK and Belgium, here in the U.S., this law, actually, it's a statutory law that allows you to bring civil suit for compensation for damages. Right now, there are two suits claims that have been filed in federal court. One of them is against Avi Dichter. Avi Dichter was a military officer in charge of intelligence during the July 2002 air raid onto Gaza, the Salah Hashhadeh bombing that murdered 15 civilians, including 8 children and 150 injured. That was the Al-Barraj neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And he was served with process. He was served with papers when he was in New York. He's currently a fellow at the Brookings Institute, and so therefore he no longer has diplomatic immunity and is able to be prosecuted here in the U.S. The second suit is against Moshe Ya'alon. Mm. Moshe Ya'alon, it was most recently the chief military officer of the Israeli Defense Forces in charge of the incursion into Jenin during the Jenin massacre, or the Jenin incursion in April 2002. But earlier in his career, he was also in charge of intelligence when the Israeli army bombed the UN compound in southern Lebanon, in Qana of southern Lebanon. That was in 1996, April 18th, 1996. So he might have thought that he had escaped immunity for almost 10 years, but we were able to serve him with process on December 15th, 2005. He is presently a military fellow at the Washington Institute for Near Eastern Policy in D.C. So again, he doesn't have diplomatic immunity either, and is able to be tried in U.S. courts for civil compensation.
So we're basically talking about war criminals.
Absolutely.
The Jenin massacre is inexcusable any way you cut it. How do you figure that these two fellows ended up with such positions of power and privilege in this country when they are known war criminals? How's that work?
I don't know how it works. I think a lot of economic interests, united economic interests, and common interests in terms of the colonization of the Arab world and the Middle East generally. War criminals and international law generally is something that's disregarded by the U.S. Government and especially the Bush administration. Justice Antonin Scalia of our Supreme Court doesn't even refer to international law as international law. He refers to it as foreign law, as something that's not even applicable to us as the U.S., as a world power. And so for them to invite former Israeli generals who are definitely in violation of international human rights, grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, which constitute war crimes, I think is something that they don't see a contradiction. In fact, Colin Powell and Bush himself were also sued under the same statute. Of course, they were provided with diplomatic immunity and weren't prosecuted. But they're also war criminals to the rest of the world.
I wonder, too, the newspapers filled with stories of Palestinian acts of terrorism against the Israeli settlements and so forth. It's rare that you see the word Palestinian when you don't see the word terrorist very close to it. When I think back and about the reports and the images of what happened in Jenin, and of course that recalls Fallujah more recently, but what happened in Jenin, to me, I would describe that as a terrorist act. And I fail to understand why the rest of the world cannot see that that in fact constitutes terrorism against the civilian population. What do you say on that?
I definitely agree, and I think it's a matter of power. If you have power, you definitely have the agency to be able to define words. So terrorism is a very loaded word. If we look to its definition, it's the use of fear and violence against the civilian population to achieve political ends. Now, if you're applying that, and you're applying that just as it's defined, then Fallujah would constitute terrorism. The incursion into Jenin would constitute terrorism. The bombing of Vieques would constitute terrorism. But because we are able to spin that word and its definition, it only becomes terrorism when a civilian population uses that type of tactics. So if an army used it, it's no longer terrorism. So when the Israeli army uses it, when the U.S. army uses it, all of a sudden it becomes a legitimate act of state. I contest that. And that's why I see the salience in litigation and human rights litigation to be able to negate that this is actually a legitimate state action. Moreover, since at least 67, the word terrorism and Arab and Muslim have all been collapsed into a single conception. So in people's imagination, you say Arab, they think Muslim. You say Muslim, they think Arab. And both Arab and Muslim, they think terrorist. And that's been reinforced by our media, by our, you know, movies coming out of Hollywood. All of it seems to be achieving the same end.
Seems that Bush really did mean crusade when he said crusade.
Absolutely.
Pat Robertson is one of the greatest minds of the 11th century. Can you talk a little bit about the Caterpillar tractor campaign? Because we know what those tractors are used for, basically, as an instrument of war, right?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, one military officer in the West Bank referred to Caterpillar bulldozers as, quote, the key weapon in the military occupation of the West Bank. These are bulldozers that are produced or manufactured in Peoria, then shipped to Israel, where they are modified by the Israeli military in the Ramta division. They are equipped with bulletproof windows, with a 6-foot ripper in the front, a 15-foot blade in the back, and a military grenade launcher.
Sounds expensive. Who pays for it, the United States or Israel?
That's contested. There's two ways that these bulldozers can be sold to Israel. One is foreign military sales program. The other is the foreign military finance program. In the former, the foreign military sales, what would happen is that the U.S. government buys them from Caterpillar and sells them to Israel, meaning it's a function of the executive branch, something that we'll never be able to touch because of, executive power. Yeah. But in the latter situation, in the foreign military financing, the U.S. actually would give aid to Israel, part of their $5 billion package a year in aid to Israel, and Israel would buy the bulldozers directly from Caterpillar, thereby enabling us as, I guess, legal advocates to take them to task for selling those bulldozers straight to Israel. And, you know, you mentioned that we know what those bulldozers do. But just, I mean, to just think about, imagine that here is America's sweetheart corporation that builds your neighborhoods, that farms your lands. You know, in our imaginations, they're very, they invoke very happy thoughts, right?
Yeah, and positive thoughts. Build more houses, right?
Build your community, yeah. Expand your church, expand your synagogue. I mean, they're thought of as a very, community-based yeah. corporation. And in fact, parents and adults buy Caterpillar bulldozer toys for their nieces and nephews. Yeah. You know, imagine if a Palestinian child were to see this and what that reminds them of when they saw their home demolished not once or twice, but three times, as in the case of the Al-Shawamri family in the north of Ramallah.
Yeah.
And so these bulldozers up to date have been used to demolish, according to Human Rights Watch, 4,170 homes between September 2000 and April 2005. They've been used to uproot 1,083,065 olive trees.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. These aren't just, this is not sort of a crop that might have been, you know, a piece of land that might have been in, you know, owned by a person for 10, 20 years. These have been around for
centuries. Centuries. Olive trees are known as the immortal tree, particularly because not only do they grow up to 400 years, but at 200 years they reshoot their roots back into the ground and grow again. So they never die. I mean, even if they die, they regenerate themselves so that they've always existed on the land, and they're an indicator of the indigenous population that has lived there. And not only are they a symbol of the rootedness of the Palestinian people to the land and their connection, but they're the source of economic livelihood for Palestinians. Those olives are not only sold as olives by the peasants who grow them, but they're also made into olive oil, which are also sold, thereby representing the one form of trade that many farmers actually use in order to provide for their families. And don't think that it's not deliberate. To go to the heart of the economic livelihood of Palestinian farmers, you're basically forcing them to leave. If they have no way to provide for their families, to make a living, they have no choice but to leave the land.
But where do they go?
They have to find a way out. And they go to neighboring Arab countries. They come to the United States. They leave to Europe. My father left in 1970 after the 1967 occupation of the West Bank. He was from East Jerusalem, from a village called Abu Dis. During the economic starvation in that time, he was forced to leave and has been in the U.S. ever since. So this idea of forcing people to leave isn't something that's consequential. It's a deliberate, programmatic, systematic strategy on behalf of the Israeli government, and it's part of an ethnic cleansing project that began in 1948 to rid the land of its people, and which negates the myth that Palestine was a land without a people for a people without a land. Mm-hmm. It's always been populated, and that's been the conundrum. How do you rid the land of a people for the land of its people for a people who want the land? And this is part of that. You starve them, you drive them out, you kill them, you scare them, you give them no choice but to leave.
Yeah, virtually rain down terror on their lives. What about this? The upcoming election? And we had a bit of a story about, I believe the Israeli government wanted to interdict campaigning in East Jerusalem. They could have, for example, they could have the election, but you couldn't campaign. Speak a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, this is about the January 25th upcoming Palestinian yes. municipal elections that haven't actually, the last elections were held 10 years ago. So this is monumental for the Palestinian people and those who want to invoke a democracy, which, and needless to say, it's so hypocritical that here is the U.S. mandating and trying to commandeer who represents themselves in these elections, negating what a democratic election should look like. In a democracy, anybody should be able to run. and be a representative of its people. But in something other than a democracy, say a puppet government, you decide who gets to run and how many votes they get. And so when the U.S. Intervenes and says that these won't be legitimate elections if Hamas is able to run in these elections, and when Israel then sets the standards, you're basically saying, look, you can have a democracy if they are on our terms and if they're going to do what we tell them to do, which is also flies in the face of U.S. governmental rhetoric and what they're trying to do in Iraq. Apparently, we invaded Iraq in order to erect democracy and to rid it of tyranny. And then here we are trying to shape what a democracy looks like. Obviously, I feel like we might not all agree with what all Palestinian political parties do, but that doesn't give us the right to then decide who gets to run for those elections. We either are for democracy or against it. And if we're against it, then drop the veil of rhetorical lies.
Yeah. About Hamas, the U.S. government would describe Hamas as a terrorist organization. However, there's a great deal of evidence, information that Hamas provides food and shelter to displaced persons, helps people get their paperwork together when their houses, for example, been bulldozed, and has helped with severe healthcare needs very often. I mean, often ambulances are stopped. Hamas has been actually functioning as a sort of a social service, unofficially.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about Hamas? I think there's a great many misunderstandings of what that group actually does.
Sure. I mean, I think what we take for granted is that the Palestinian Authority is not a functioning body. The Palestinian Authority is an aesthetic representation of the Palestinian people, but that their police and security headquarters are bombed. The Palestinian radio stations and television stations are bombed. The offices are raided so that their papers are taken away. They essentially strip the Palestinian Authority of any power, of any authority, of any efficacy to serve its people, leaving grassroots organizations and political parties to fill in the function and the void that a state should do for its people. And that's what happened in the first Intifada, when you had NGOs literally becoming the quasi-state for the Palestinian people. They were its caretakers. They took care of orphans. They took care of food needs. They were able to provide for women's health care. The more you destroy the efficacy of the Palestinian Authority, the more power you're giving to these organizations such as Hamas. And Hamas has done, I mean, it might anger people, but Hamas has done a wonderful job of stepping in to fill that gap. They have built schools, provided the teachers at those schools. They provide food services, women's health. They provide assistance to farmers and to male adults seeking work. They do the job that a government should be doing for its people, but the Palestinian government isn't able to do anything. It's literally ineffective. It's defunct because of Israeli targeting of its institutional capacities.
So Hamas, in a way, would be present more of a threat to the powers that be in the Middle East, that being, of course, Israel and the United States. They are, in effect, Hamas would be more of a threat as a social service organization than a terrorist organization, much the same way as the Black Panthers were in this country. They were a social service organization,
right, right.
And they were a tremendous threat and had to be wiped out. Given all of this, how do you see... What is the transition in Israel and Palestine with the departure of Ariel Sharon from the political theater? How is that going to affect the Palestinian people and what we call the peace process?
Well, Ariel Sharon was able to bring to the political theater, the political stage in the last, I would say, 5 years more than anything, a unilateral approach to dealing with the Palestinians, thereby negating the facade of a negotiation or a peace process. Ariel Sharon decided that he had a vision for Israel, what Eretz Yisrael would look like, and he would create that on the ground unilaterally. And he got the green light from Bush in an April 2004 letter. During that time, Sharon wrote a letter to our current president, George W. Bush, and said, I will withdraw from Gaza, the Gaza Strip. I will withdraw the settlements from the Gaza Strip if I'm allowed to continue the building of the annexation wall, by the way, deemed illegal in the July 2004 International Court of Justice ruling. If I'm able to build that annexation wall however I like, in order to annex the settlements and more land and more water resources from the West Bank, unhindered, and then to declare the end of occupation. I mean, he didn't say that in so many words, the end of occupation, but this is something that I anticipate. And Bush said, go ahead. You have my blessing. And this type of unilateralism is something that only Sharon could have done because of his legacy as a military war monster. He was responsible for the massacre in Qibya in 1956. He was responsible for the oversight of the massacre in Sabra and Shatila in 1982. He is responsible for the expansion of settlements and the development of settlement programs in Israel since its inception. So for Ariel Sharon to come and do this and say this to Israeli people, they're pretty much going to trust them. And Palestinians have no choice, especially the Palestinian Authority, who are trying to negotiate and achieve peace, are looking around like, well, what do we do now? And they can do nothing. So what he's brought is a new sense of unilateralism that those before him have actually also endorsed. Ehud Olmert, who was the mayor of Israel, Jerusalem, for years actually supported the idea of unilateralism before Sharon. He's currently the deputy prime minister of Israel, and if he were to be elected, he would continue with this program. But Ehud Olmert, like Amir Peretz, like Shimon Peres, like Benjamin Netanyahu, all face the same challenge in that they don't have the same military legacy of Sharon, and therefore would have to prove their military might were they to come to power. And were any of those four to be elected in the upcoming Israeli elections, they would definitely do a number on Palestinians, a huge number of in terms of violence and devastation and murder, in order to prove their military prowess to the Israeli public. So it couldn't get better at this point.
Is there anyone at all that you think would be a better aside from the names that you've mentioned? Is there anyone at all in the Israeli, on the political scene there, that would make a positive difference in the region? Do you have any hopes for anyone at all emerging? Prison, for example.
Right. I've heard that Raji Surani actually hopes that it's Amir Peretz, because he has more of a favorable attitude towards peace and the peace process. Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean, I guess something, but that's necessarily my opinion. I would love to see an Arab Israeli, a Palestinian Israeli come to power, somebody like Azmi Bshara, somebody who actually, you know, concedes the history of the creation of Israel on the land, and not someone who negates that history and continues to purport this myth of it being a land without a people or a people without a land. So long as we have that perpetual myth in place, I really don't see hope from within. But the Israeli left has taken a step forward, and I think that that's where our hope lies. The grassroots have always been the ones to actually affect change, and not the leaders. The leaders are politicians. Their job is to appease and please everybody.
And as far as the people what is going on right now as far as taking steps in the direction of achieving something that's a little bit fairer and more equitable for the Palestinian people, apart from whoever might emerge politically. Your group is based here in the United States. What groups in Palestine are working to achieve safety in the region and a better future for Palestinians and, of course, Israelis too?
As you might know, there's a divestment campaign that's actually taken hold internationally. It started here in the U.S. at the University of California in Berkeley on February 6, 2001, when the actual first election of Ariel Sharon into power, and the divestment campaign was announced to divest from Israel, to mirror the divestment from apartheid South Africa, so that we can take this into our own hands. If Israel is only able to survive with U.S. aid, then U.S. aid is what we need to deny it, in order for it to actually comport with international humanitarian and human rights laws. So on the ground, this has taken hold all across the U.S., and for those university students who are interested, the 5th Annual Palestine Solidarity Movement Conference is going to happen, I think it's President's Day weekend, February 15th through the 18th at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. I encourage you to sign up and to join us there. Israel proper divestment campaigns have also taken hold. Ilan Pape, an Israeli professor from Haifa University, has long called for the boycott of Israel. I once heard him say, I did an interview with him, and he has literally said, boycott me. Boycott me. Don't let me come, because it sends a clear message to Israel that sees itself as a moral haven in a non-democratic Arab world. You know, slap it in the face and let it know you are doing nothing moral in the continuation of your existence as it is. And then also in March 2006, there's a coalition of grassroots Palestinian organizations within and without Israel that is launching its own divestment campaign. And what it's hoping to do is to identify 3 Israeli products that are very prominent in Palestinian households. You know, being occupied territories were also captured markets for the Israeli economy. So identify 3 prominent Israeli products, boycott them. The Palestinian population plans to boycott them within and without the Green Line, and all, thereby declaring its integration into the international boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement.
So listeners, you know what to do. That's Noura Erekat, and there's been a lot of information put out there on the airwaves this morning in this program, and I imagine all of this information and much more, of course, could be found at your website.
Absolutely.
Can you give all that information one more time?
Sure. www.endtheoccupation, which is one word, .org is our website. If you'd like to contact me to come either on the legal work or on the organizing side, you can email me at legal@endtheoccupation.org, and you can call us at 202-543-1778.
And we'll have all of that information at the front desk for you. And I want to thank Noura once again. She's had a busy schedule here in Portland. And I want to thank her very, very much for coming here. Thank you, Noura.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Shukran. Mm-hmm. And let's see. It is now 10:58 a.m. You're listening to KBOO Radio, your community radio. My name is Chris Andre. And we're moving right along to Democracy Now! In just a few moments. Thanks for listening.
And today on Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, possibly with Juan Gonzalez, will feature more analysis of the ongoing hearings of the Senate Judiciary Committee regarding referring the nomination of Judge Samuel Alito to the full Senate for his Supreme Court nomination. So stay tuned for that after these brief announcements.
This is Ramona Africa, and you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your dial. KBOO is the exact example of the community taking charge of itself. On the move.
Anin in Dinoe Manganatak, Nigagwe, Gitamagas, Nungam, Bine Sikwe, Irigo Makwa, Indo Deam, Gaba, Saga Eganing, Indunjava, Miguich, Miguich.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 or on the web at radiocab.net.